What I want to do in this week is I want to pull together some of the themes that we've been working with. And in particular, what I'm going to do today is pull together some ideas about integrating dichotomous or conflicting elements in the mind on the path to wholeness. And then tomorrow I'll talk about Thomas Berry's article, which I've given you to read. So if you haven't read it yet, be sure to read it before tomorrow, because it's complicated material. And it represents a kind of counterpoint, a Christian counterpoint, to some of the Buddhist material that I've been talking about, which I'll conclude with today. And then on Wednesday, I will do a final wrap-up. So that pretty much will pull things to a close. I don't think probably I'll have anything more to say beyond that lecture, but I might. So I don't know if we'll actually need to meet again after that, but I'm thinking that that will pull everything together. We'll see how that goes. To sort of create some context, since we've been away from the material for a little while, create some context again. Jung basically has argued that much of what is understood to be religious life and religious experience is about regaining our wholeness, a kind of wholeness that's deeper and fuller than the wholeness maybe we can even imagine, a kind of totality which we perhaps have never experienced. And that his assessment is that religion is about this. And the reason we're looking at this in the context of this class is using the psychology of religion, and Jung is as an example of this, as a way of understanding what it is that might unite religions. Because we're living in a pluralistic world where it's very hard to figure out how we're all going to get along with each other. So the class is proposing that understanding religious life as a dynamic psychological process provides a tool that people could have for figuring out how to communicate with each other and get along with each other. So that's the biggest picture. So since this is wrap-up week, it's okay to go back to the biggest picture and sort of lay that out. But then to go back to what we've been dealing with most recently, which is this Buddhist idea, what I've been proposing is that the Buddhist world and the different versions of Buddhism that have come down to us in the 20th and 21st century, when the Western scholarship on Buddhism has really been very full and ripe, that that the Buddhist world had retained tools and perspectives on the achievement of wholeness that have been pretty much lost in the West. That in the West, what's happened is a kind of splitting of a level which is even greater than the splitting that occurred in the Asian world, an internal splitting. Okay, so an example of this is the profound dichotomy that you find in Christianity, but also in Islam, which we haven't talked about too much, the profound dichotomy between the so-called forces of good and evil, heaven and hell, God and the devil, these sorts of things, which are viewed as irreconcilably discrepant and other than each other, which creates a certain sort of set of problems, both for modern people, but also create a kind of a cultural historical trajectory for the development of religion, this profound dichotomy. It wasn't always that way. In the Mediterranean world before the rise of Christianity, there were tendencies in that direction, but there are also countervailing tendencies to bring things together. And so we looked at the myth of Apollo and Dionysus, Theseus and the Minotaur, by way of understanding some of that. And I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. In the Asian world, the rift and the discrepancy was not so great. It was never really viewed by Hindus, Buddhists, or even Confucians, for that matter, or Taoists, that the forces of darkness and light, to use those examples, were opposed to each other irreconcilably. It was mostly understood that there was a dynamic relationship between the forces of darkness and light, and that that dynamic relationship could be understood as necessary for the functioning of existence, but it is also something that as an individual religious practitioner one could deal with and in a sense transcend, which is definitely not the case in the Western world. Now, if you look at this psychologically, what's being described here is kind of a projection of an internal condition into an external world. So in the Asian world, the idea would be much more like there are dynamic forces within oneself that one has to come to terms with, but it's not necessarily the case that one ultimately rejects one part of oneself and affirms another part of oneself. That's the external projection into God and the devil, right? But in the Western world, there's much more historically a sense that there are parts of oneself which need to be rejected utterly, irreconcilably, right? Now, you can't really say that the psychology, the individual psychology, has created the externalization of that in theology, or the theological externalization has created the internal state, because there's a dynamic relationship between the two of them. If you grow up as a Muslim, for example, to use that case rather than the Christian case, if you grow up as a Muslim, there are certain things that you will be culturally conditioned to accept and other things that you'll be culturally conditioned to reject, and that you can't work your way out of those things very easily. For example, you will be culturally conditioned to reject the idea at any level that you can create an image of God. If you're a Muslim, you're just almost never going to be able to get over that particular deep idea. And therefore, right, to have an internal life which is based upon visualization of icons, as the Buddhists would do, that's something that's just not an option for you. But there is a human tendency to want to deal with what these images represent or what these tendencies are. And the way the Muslims dealt with it is more abstractly. So Muslims have the 99 names of God, and they understand that the 99 names of God are not different than God, but they represent, if you will, characteristics of God. So you have God the just, God the merciful, God the wise, God, I mean, all these are all the names of God. I can't even go through what a lot of them are. How is it different to say God the compassionate, or to say Mary, Mother of God, who takes care of sinners, or to talk about Tara in the Buddhist tradition? I mean, where are these differences? In some fundamental human way, there's a kind of similarity, although in a religious sense, these things obviously appear to be different. And if you look at these tendencies within cultural context, they're distinctly different, right? So in Buddhism, Tara could appear in many colors, but she's generally young and voluptuous and sits on a lotus and is surrounded by flowers and whatnot. Mary is very chaste looking, usually covered up. You can't see her cleavage. You can only see Tara's cleavage. Allah the Merciful is a name, a sound, a calligraphic representation in calligraphy, but never in an image. And yet, this is all divine mercy. This is all divine compassion in one form or another. So there's a human quality to express this. There's a human need to express this. So it exists both internally and externally. But culturally, we deal with it differently, depending upon the way in which we're trained, we develop, where we grew up, and so on and so forth. So I think that should be relatively clear. But then, from the point of view of creating wholeness, assuming that seeking wholeness is a human need, so it's a need of Muslims, Christians, and Buddhists, then how do you seek wholeness in those different kinds of contexts? That creates different sorts of problems for you. In Asia, you can aspire to become a female Buddha. It doesn't actually matter whether you're a guy or a girl. You can still aspire to become a female Buddha. That's sort of irrelevant. reincarnation solves the problem of your physical form, right? But on the spiritual level, the idea of Buddha nature is neither male nor female. It's not restricted to any particular gender, okay? So there are routes for integration that are open to Buddhists that aren't exactly open to Muslims, for example, because you cannot imagine yourself becoming Allah the Merciful. That's not an option. You can imagine cultivating mercy, and you can imagine establishing a relationship with God in God's merciful character, and that might serve toward integration, and probably does in the Muslim world, but it's still a very different process, and different yet in the Christian world. So you understand the kind of point that I'm trying to make here, I hope. Okay. So then in that context, if we look at the question of how did the Western world split and where does the integration come from, which was our earlier theme when we were talking about mythic mind, when we were talking about Theseus and the Minotaur and Ariadne, and then we were talking about Apollo and Dionysus. How do we, as Westerners, work our way through that split and achieve wholeness? So that's sort of the question that's at hand at the moment. And part of the answer to that is going to come, I think, from the Buddhist world and not from the Western world. And the reason it doesn't come from the Western world is that, on the whole, Western theologians haven't been able to figure out how to solve this problem. Okay. In the 19th century, one of the great philosophers was Friedrich Nietzsche. So this may or may not be a name that you're familiar with. Okay. In Nietzsche's writings, he actually divided human beings and the internal character of human beings into two fundamental tendencies, which he called Apollonian and Dionysian, for a reason. And Nietzsche did not conclude that there was a resolution between the Apollonian and the Dionysian tendencies. He saw them as being in conflict with each other. He didn't see a resolution there at all. Now, Nietzsche died crazy from syphilis, but nevertheless, he died crazy. So this suggests that for himself, there was no potential resolution, but he couldn't see one socially or culturally. And in the 20th century, a lot of thinkers talked about this split, this Dionysian-Apollonian split. When you read textbooks or historical studies done by philosophers of history in the first half of the 20th century, you start seeing this Apollonian-Dionysian split being discussed by these people. So this is a very influential kind of idea. Anyhow, my main point is that we're not going to find the resolution to this problem in the Western tradition, at least not in the Western theological tradition. When we talk about Thomas Berry tomorrow, I'll show you a potential resolution that comes out of the scientific tradition, which is perhaps left field for theology. Okay, so how does it work in the Buddhist tradition? Well, because the Buddhists didn't have the same kind of rigid division of dark and light, good and bad and whatnot, that Christians and Muslims have, different options were open to them, which is what I was indicating. So, if, for example, we ask the question about the Dionysian and the Apollonian, let's go back to these two images that I showed you. So this will be a little bit of a stretch to understand, but we'll give it a shot anyway. So Manjushri, and here's this image of Manjushri, is said to be the Buddha of wisdom. Now all this means is the Buddha of wisdom, everyone has the potential to become a Buddha within themselves. A Buddha is a person who has woken up to their true nature. So everybody in this room, everybody on this planet, has the potential to be a Buddha if they cultivate the qualities that are necessary. I won't go into what all that means because that would take us pretty far afield. This isn't a class on Buddhism. But the main point is in the Buddhist tradition, everybody has the potential to become a Buddha, and what religious life is about is cultivating that potential and becoming that, So along the way to becoming that, you can cultivate the potentials of wisdom, you can cultivate the potentials of compassion, you can cultivate the potentials of energy. There are a lot of possibilities. Like the 99 names of God, there are lots of different Buddhas that represent different kind of characteristics. And there's a similarity in the West. Think of all the different saints, right? Saint Christopher is the saint that takes care of travelers. So you could read, what is Saint Christopher about, and devotion to Saint Christopher as, what are the characteristics you need to have to be a successful traveler? I mean, maybe that's a stretch. I don't know. I haven't thought too much about it. But anyway, so this Buddha is, this is Buddha expressing himself as a form of wisdom. Usually we see Buddha sitting cross-legged with his hands in his lap, you know, and his fingers together, and he looked kind of peaceful. If you go to Japanese tea gardens in a lot of places, you see these Japanese Buddhas sitting there very indrawn looking. They're not holding books. This is a book, sitting on a lotus, not holding a book in his left hand. That's what the, sort of the representation is, even though there's a flower and a petal and a stem here. Or holding a flaming sword. You don't generally see that in tea gardens. But the sword all over the world represents wisdom, and the book obviously represents wisdom. So Buddhists cultivate this, and they do this. We talked about the way in which the idea of a person, I, is just a designation on the body-mind complex. Remember that from the earlier lectures. The Buddhist tradition is to imagine this image, to imagine oneself as this, designated on their body-mind. So the actual cultivation practice is to say, I have this characteristic of being wise. I'm going to imagine myself as a wise person. So I'm no longer, you know, David in his late 60s who's kind of creaking out of bed in the morning and so on and so forth. I'm this young, wise Buddha person. And the body changes, but that doesn't matter because my essential nature is this young, wise Buddha person. And I'm going to cultivate that. So this is what they actually do. So they sit and they meditate and they imagine no longer that I am David Professor, but rather that I am David Manjushri, wise Buddha. And just as we talked about the example of cultivating one's skills as a golfer by imagining oneself swinging like Tiger Woods, you know, hitting the golf ball like Tiger Woods, so you imagine your relationship with everything, your own mind and the world, as Buddha having that relation. You are Buddha having that relationship with the world. So does this work? Is it effective? Does it really bring about a degree of integration? Well, for one thing, according to the Buddhists anyway, this tendency for wisdom is there within you. It may be subconscious, but it is there within you, and you can cultivate it. Most of us don't tend to feel very wise. We probably don't even know what wisdom is. Higher education teaches us facts and the integration of facts and maybe a certain amount of creative thought. But even most faculty members will admit that you don't go to college for wisdom, that that's something else. That there's fact, there's knowledge, and there's wisdom. It's kind of like a hierarchy of understanding. And when you go to college, you might get fact. If you work at it, you'll get knowledge, but wisdom, that's a different thing. And mostly you don't find wisdom at Badgley Hall or Ackerman Hall or Loso Hall. You find it someplace else. Okay, but now here's the interesting thing. Here is my hypothesis. I can't prove this, but this is my hypothesis. Manjushri is the same as Apollo. Okay. If you look at the characteristics of Apollo as described by the Greeks and the characteristics of Manjushri as described by the Buddhists, they're pretty similar. They're solar. I mean, well, for one thing, look at the color of Manjushri. It's the color of the sun. In this case, Manjushri is orange, but sometimes he's more like yellow. Okay. If you look at all the characteristics of Manjushri, you see that he's solar in character. He's solar in nature. Okay. So just take it for granted for the moment that I say that and that maybe I'm right about it, okay? I can't prove it. Well, I suppose I could. If we had enough time and I had enough texts, I could probably prove it, but we're not going to go that place right now. Now here, This is where I think things get interesting from some from another point of view. Remember I showed you this picture of this Yamantaka? This is a man. Let's see if I show you the full picture. This is a man with the body of a man, with the head of a bull or a water buffalo. There aren't actually too many bulls per se in India, but it tends to be a water buffalo, and with flames. This is a very fierce-looking creature. Probably looks much more like what Greeks might have thought the Minotaur looked like, and that's my point. Probably much more what Greeks thought the Minotaur looked like. I mean, if you met this guy in a dark alley, it'd scare the bejesus out of you, no question about it. If you met him in a labyrinth, you would certainly be in trouble, no question about that either. Well, in this image, he might be actually perhaps only about 8 inches, but he's full size in your imagination. Right? He's full size in your imagination. Pretty fierce looking. Okay, my hypothesis is that this is Dionysus, not actually the Minotaur, but Dionysus. And Dionysus and the Minotaur are related to each other. If you go back to our earlier conversations about this and you look at Greek lore, Dionysus and the Minotaur are related to each other. They both represent this earlier kind of matriarchal element that was, I say matriarchal element, but they represent the consort of the goddess from the earliest times. The bull was the consort of the goddess. The horns of the moon, the bull's head, ferocity. Why ferocity? Well, we go back to what Bly told us about the four faces of the mother. Dionysus is associated with not just intoxication, but also dismemberment. And why dismemberment? Well, all I have to say is go down to the other side of town and look at a few meth addicts, and you'll understand what I mean about intoxication and its relationship with dismemberment. Or go down to parts of Portland, maybe not Portland anymore, but wherever there's an aggregation of heroin addicts. All right, you look at people who've gotten seriously involved in drugs in an abusive way, not in a kind of a light way, not like going to a rave and getting high and then going about your life for the rest of the week, but people who are seriously addicted to drugs, they dismember you. They literally dismember you, you know. I don't know if you've seen any of these before and afters of photographs of meth addicts. You can find them on the internet, right? Well, you see what's going on. This is the kind of dismemberment that's associated with certain kinds of intoxication. So the Greeks understood this. They didn't have meth. They didn't have heroin. They probably didn't even have opium. But they certainly had wine. And maybe for them that was enough. Or maybe they had other drugs that we're not familiar with. Hard to tell how pervasive the spread of cannabis was. So they may have had access to that. I don't actually know. But anyway, so again, so here's my hypothesis. Apollo, Dionysus, Manjushri, Yamantaka. Now Yamantaka, interestingly, the term actually means the slayer of death. And I may not get into this too much, but this is the way death is portrayed in the Buddhist world. Another bull-headed humanoid figure. So why is the slayer of death and death, why are they similar? Because, what do we say when you're drunk and you, what do you have for hangovers? The hair of the dog that bit you? You have Bloody Mary in the morning when you had too much to drink the previous night? I don't know. I don't know how to explain this, quite honestly. So we'll just sort of leave it at that. But point is, just a second. The point is that Buddhists understand this relationship of Apollo and Dionysus, by my understanding, by my interpretation perhaps, as the relationship of Manjushri and Yamantaka. Now here's the interesting thing. Buddhists say that there's no difference between the two of them. That Manjushri is the peaceful form of Yamantaka and Yamantaka is the fierce form of Manjushri. That they represent the same thing. And in fact, the way they do the meditation practice is they kind of imagine those two things superimposed on each other at the same time. So this is a little stretch for us to understand, but essentially what they're doing is they're saying that this dichotomy exists within me and outside of me, and the way I resolve the dichotomy is by understanding that I'm no different than it. That I have the elements within me of this fierce bullheaded deity, which is wise, and I have the elements within me of Manjushri. And they actively work with this to resolve that discrepancy, that split, which is the Apollonian Dionysian, which Nietzsche could not resolve in his own philosophy, which he considered irresolvable, as far as I know. Okay, so the Buddhists say they can resolve it through meditation practice. And if they do resolve it through meditation practice, that opens up a whole different dimension of themselves. Because if we go back to thinking about what Wittmann was telling us, what is it that prevents us from integrating the mental, mythic, and magical minds, that prevents us from integrating our mental selves, our emotional selves, and our physical bodily selves? If the split exists between Apollo and Dionysus in our mind, in our dream life, in our emotional life, how can we get down to the even deeper level, which is associated with the body, and create full integration? Because where the split exists and the tension exists, integration is impossible. So again, the Buddhists say you develop the integration at this level, and then you can integrate your full dynamic nature, mental, mythic, magical selves, all can be integrated. This would be their argument. Now, is it possible or not? Well, I've met a lot of Buddhists who've gone through this type of meditation practice and others. They seem pretty remarkable to me, right? Okay. So this may seem pretty far out there, but the Dalai Lama, for example, is a very respected figure in the world. But this is something, this is a practice he does on a daily basis. He does his practice daily. I know this, okay? Because it's one of the basics of his tradition to do this. And so he's a master of it. And he seems like a pretty integrated cat, you know? So I think the potential is there. Now, is the potential there for the West? Is the potential there for Americans? This is a different question. Let me take your question, Alex, and then I'll come to that.
Actually, you answered
it. Did I answer it? Oh,
yeah, I was just asking, like, if you see the picture of Yama or Yamataka, they look very fearsome, but it represents both good and evil because the Buddhists don't see a difference. But then you answered my question.
Okay.
How they
right.
Do that.
Right, and that's the way they do that, because they see Yamataka as like two sides of a coin. Yamantaka is one side of the coin, and Manjushri is the other. I don't know, heads or tails. What would be heads or tails?
Would that be the Kali?
Kali would be different. That's something else. Yeah. After class, I'll talk to you about Kali if you want. Yeah.
I was wondering, is it kind of, there's no good without evil?
Yeah, that would be a way of thinking about it, because good and evil, to a certain extent, from the Buddhist point of view, anyway, to a certain extent, good and evil have to do with what do we take to be good or evil, right? Now, it doesn't mean that Buddhists don't view there being negative things in the world, but the word evil would not necessarily be something they would apply to them. For example, harming other people is considered something you absolutely do not want to do. You don't want to create pain. You don't want to create pain for any people, for any living thing. This is a Buddhist virtue, not creating pain. We would say that's creating pain is evil. They wouldn't necessarily use that language. So, for example, we have a last judgment in the Christian world and in the Muslim world. You die, and depending upon your theology, after you die, you're judged. You either go to heaven or you go to hell. There are different theologies about when that happens, but you're judged by God. Right? You're judged by God. In the Buddhist world, what they say is you die and you go into this dreamlike state. And in this state, you find yourself facing the Lord of Death, who we saw, Yama. And when you face the Lord of Death, he holds up a mirror and you see yourself for what you really are and what your life has been. And if your life has been really great, then you get reborn in a good situation. But if your life has been really bad, you get reborn in a bad situation. But it's not like anybody judges you. You look in the mirror and see yourself, and it's kind of like, holy moly, yikes, what have I been doing? You go to a bad place. You send yourself to that place by your own reaction to your own life. That's more the Buddhist view of things. Okay, so I'm proposing that there is this this way of resolving the dialectic between Apollonian and Dionysian, and that it works for the Buddhists, but would it work for us? Okay, because I mean these images are alien to our way of thinking, and they're alien to us. So in the early 80s, I interviewed the Dalai Lama for the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. And the first time I interviewed him, I had my own questions for him. The second time I interviewed him, actually the second and third times I interviewed him, I came equipped with questions that the editors of the journal had given me based upon the publication of the first interview. So one of the questions was, well, there are a lot of Americans who are trying to practice Buddhism. And that means they're working with these images, like some of the images that I've shown you. But those are Buddhist images. And, you know, they're kind of this whole cultural thing in Buddhism, which is really different than Western culture, different language, different history, different mental dispositions. So how's it going to be possible, do you think, really, for Westerners to use these images and in some way make changes in their own internal state, and to use our language, to achieve this kind of completeness that Jung would say is what the religious path is about, and which would, if everyone understood that, perhaps would open up some options for dialogue among religions. So the Dalai Lama said something really interesting to me in response to that. He said, well, working with these images has worked for us here in Tibet for the last 1600 years, oh no, last 1400 years, last 1200 or 1400 years. He said, but you know, all this stuff came from India. Didn't come from Tibet. All these images of Manjushri and Yamantaka and all this other stuff and the Buddha, that all came from India. So the Indians have a very different language than Tibetans. It's true, the Indo-European language and the Tibeto-Burman language are linguistically utterly unlike. Different cultural history, totally. Different political history, totally. Different climate. I mean, can you imagine two climates any more different than India and Tibet? I mean, the lowlands of Tibet are at 12,000 feet. No monsoon in Tibet, that's for sure. No jungles in Tibet, you know. He said, so, but all this stuff came from India to Tibet. That's where it originated. It's worked for us. He said, so is it the case that Tibetans and Indians of the ancient world were any more radically different from each other than Tibetans and Americans? He said, I don't think so. He said, there's something in human beings that's similar, that it will work. Now, if you go to any of his public talks, he'll say right off, you know, I'm not here to proselytize. It's best for people to stick with their own religion. Unless for some reason it's really not working for them, then they might want to look at another religion. So if you're here and you're listening to me do a teaching on Buddhist religion, I'm not trying to convert you. If you're just curious, that's fine. Sit here and listen. If you want to be a Buddhist, that's okay too, but I really don't recommend you do that. That's kind of an interesting idea for how to proselytize or how to bring your religion to another culture. So he does say that, but nevertheless, he will also say that these images can work in different cultures. Now, that's very interesting because Carl Jung says they don't. Okay. So take your pick. You can believe whatever you want. I'm not going to say one thing or another. I'm just going to say the Buddhists, like Dalai Lama, will say that the images that are associated with our cultural tradition and our history have a psychological efficacy that is transformative for anybody at any time, if they engage in meditation practice in the right way. Carl Jung makes the argument that we all have our own internal archetypal history, if you will, and the images that work in one culture may not, or certainly do not, I think he wrote different things at different times, do not work, right, for other cultures. I know he said that Westerners are not going to resolve the religious problems facing Westerners by adopting the, I think he calls it, the robes and appurtenances of the Asian world, that we have to find our own way. So you take your pick. Those are just two different hypotheses. Yet, Jung does believe that there are similar underlying human issues that we deal with all over the world. That the Apollonian-Dionysian split is something that all peoples are going to have to deal with. I think he just believes that different peoples are going to have to deal with it differently, with different images or different technologies. Since he's been dead for a while, we can't ask him. And his understanding of Buddhism was limited by the Buddhist scholarship of the times. And if it had changed, if it had developed more during his lifetime, perhaps some of his thoughts might have changed. That I don't know. Okay, that is the point at which I want to leave things today. But I want to return, as I said, to this other set of ideas that Thomas Berry has. And just sort of as a preview of where we're going with this. Berry was a Catholic theologian. Okay, so I don't want to just be finishing this class dealing with the Asian materials. I'm looking at the Asian materials because I think that they provide something informative in the study of religion, which we wouldn't otherwise understand just based upon the Western tradition. But Berry is firmly in the Western tradition of Catholic theology. Okay, he taught at Fordham. I don't think he was a Jesuit, but he was very interested in theology that was developed by a Jesuit, and I'll tell you more about this next time we meet. And just as a preview, in his view, the solution to the problem of becoming whole has something to do with literally evolution, and understanding evolution from the point of view of the evolution of culture, the evolution of the physical human body, the evolution of mind, the evolution of spirit, if you will. And that's what we'll talk about tomorrow. So not so much that we want to talk about ecology, but the way in which, because he does talk about this, but the way in which he talks about evolution, because he considers evolution the new story. That's what he calls it. He calls it the new story. So if you think back to the mythology we've been studying, and we think back to Joseph Campbell was saying, mythology is a story. Mythologies are stories that help us make sense of our life, that help us to grow our life, to understand our human journey toward wholeness, and that the hero's journey is a journey toward becoming whole. It's a story. So Berry proposes a new kind of story, and I'd like to compare it also, when we talk about this tomorrow, with one last Buddhist idea, which is the idea Buddhists call the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is a person who is set on the path of becoming a Buddha, which is to say becoming whole. It's an evolutionary developmental path. So I'm going to compare that with what Berry has to say. Okay? So that's for the next lecture.